In the 10th chapter of Joshua, we had the story of how Joshua and the army of the Israelites subdued the southern part of the land of Canaan, in particular those five kings that had joined together to fight against Israel as a unit. They subdued them. Now in the 11th chapter, we're going to have the story of how Joshua and his army subdued the northern part of the kingdom of Canaan. And this seems to be a harder job to do because there's going to be what appears to be a lot more men involved, although we have no spectacular accounts of the great miracles like we did in the conquering of the southern half. There won't be any miracle like the sun standing still or the great rain of hailstones on the opposing armies like we had in the previous chapters. But as is typical with God and His people, when the people are young and babes and weak, He uses His miracles to help them to gain strength and experience. And then when they grow up from the childhood state into the manhood state, there's no more need for these great miraculous events. And He allows the people then to use their own strength and follow the principles of God without miracles to bring about these great accomplishments. It's true also in the New Testament church. In the beginning, there was the miraculous giving of the word. There were many other miracles in the forms of gifts. But today, now that we no longer have those miraculous gifts as recorded in the New Testament, we find that we just follow the great principles of God. We have His word in the written form, in a complete and entire form, and we depend upon these things to be our strength, the sword of the Spirit, rather than the miraculous intervention of God. So beginning with the first verse of the 11th chapter of Joshua, "And it came to pass, when Jabin, king of Hazor, had heard of those sayings, that he sent to Jobab, king of Madon, and to the king of Shimron, and to the king of Asshaph." Now it seemed that Jabin, the king of Hazor, was the moving force here. He probably had more authority and was the leader of the group. He was similar to Adonizedek, the king of Jerusalem, who led the group of five kings in the south. And these kings that are named here, and these cities that they are kings of, are located in the northern part of the land of Canaan. And as we see, this is going to be a battle then for the northern part of that kingdom. Verse 2, "And to the kings that were on the north of the mountains, and of the plain south of Shinaroth, and in the valley, and in the borders of Dor on the west, and to the Canaanite on the east and on the west, and to the Amorite, and to the Hittite, and to the Perizzite, and the Jebusite in the mountains, and to the Hivite under Hermon in the land of Mizpah." In these verses, he's just simply naming the kings and the areas from which they came as they joined together now against the army of Joshua. Verse 4, "And they went out, they and all their hosts with them, much people, even as the sand that is upon the seashore in multitude, with horses and chariots very many." So we see here this is going to be a much larger army than Joshua had encountered before. He describes them as being even as the sand that is upon the seashore in multitude. Not only that, but this army also has, mentioned for the first time, the use of horses and chariots, very many. The horses, of course, would be used not only to pull the chariots, but then horses used to have soldiers to ride upon them to give them more mobility and a different element of warfare, actually. Josephus says that this army had 300,000 foot soldiers, 10,000 horse soldiers, and 20,000 chariots. So there's quite a number, quite a formidable group now, which is described here as being even as the sand that is upon the seashore in multitude. Verse 5, "And when all these kings were met together, they came and pitched together at the waters of Merom to fight against Israel." So these kings are the aggressors now. They have chosen their own place for the battle near the waters of Merom. And as we know, that's the little lake that originally has the early waters that come off of Mount Hermon, and then the waters that come off of this lake drain into the Sea of Galilee, and this is the formation of the Jordan River. So it's in the extreme north portion of Canaan. They've chosen their own battleground. They are the aggressors. Of course, we know that God has hardened their hearts to do this. They're not wanting to make any kind of covenant with Israel. They're not wanting to become their tributaries, their servants, or to be proselytes to their religion. They're going to break this army of Joshua, if at all possible. So they've united together. Now, we that are children of God need to take a lesson from this. It seems that the forces of evil are always ready and willing to unite together so that they can fight the common enemy, which would then be the forces of God. But it also seems that it's very much a tendency on the part of the people of God to become divided and to not unite together and to then lose a lot of their strength that they could have because of quarreling and bickering among themselves. So a great lesson here. In the uniting together for a common cause, there is much more strength. Now, another thing we need to notice is that if these kings had have combined together with the kings in the south, and this country is small enough that they could have easily done that, then they would have even had a greater army for Joshua to have had to have overcome. But no doubt this is according to the plan of God. The kings of the south united together first, five kings, a smaller army. Joshua was able to conquer them. And then, having gotten them subdued, then he can turn to the kings of the north, and then they unite together. But rather than all of the kings of the whole nation uniting together in a common cause, they didn't do this. They failed to do this. And we see now Joshua and his men have more experience at war. They have a better ability to take on such a foe as this. And so here again, this is according to God's plan. God only puts upon us those things that we're able to bear. And as this army became more experienced, then they had a greater job to do in the foe that they fought against. So in verse 6, "And the Lord said unto Joshua, Be not afraid because of them, for tomorrow about this time will I deliver them up all slain before Israel. Thou shalt hold their horses and burn their chariots with fire." Now, to hold the horses means that they would cut the hamstrings of the horses and make them lame. And, of course, to burn the chariots with fire would be to absolutely destroy these chariots, and they would not be kept for other uses. Now, God simply tells Joshua, do not be afraid of them. Be not afraid because of them. And that's a very pertinent lesson for us to have today at any time. Regardless of how great our foes are, how many they are, how united they are against us, the simple thing, be not afraid because of them. We don't have to fear them. God's going to be with us. God's going to allow us to come through according to His will, whatever His will happens to be. And so He tells Joshua very specifically, for tomorrow about this time will I deliver them up all slain before Israel. So about 24 hours from now, Joshua, you're going to have the victory. Tomorrow about this time. Now this was designed, of course, to give Joshua strength and courage. And he could lead his men without any hesitation. He knew that he had the victory. Now, you know, when we go into a battle, when we go into a situation of trial, a situation in which we stand a chance to lose if we cannot be victorious, it's always well for us to make that contact with God before this happens. Let's get down on our knees and let's pray to God. Let's approach Him in the humblest manner that we know. And let's ask Him to remove any difficulty that may be between us and God. Let's get things right with God. Let's not have a sin like the children of Israel had in their midst when they first went against the city of Ai and were made to fail. Let's get rid of those sins. Let's get right with God. Let's be in harmony with God. And then we're going to be able to enter into the battle and gain the victory. And so that's what it said here. The Lord said to Joshua. So we know Joshua had contact with God. He was making sure now that everything was harmonious between him and the people and God. And then God said, "Be not afraid because of them, for tomorrow about this time will I deliver them up, all slain before Israel." Verse 7, "So Joshua came, and all the people of war with him, against them by the waters of Merom suddenly, and they fell upon them." Here was this great army of several hundred thousand camped out now around the waters of Merom, Lake Hula. And Joshua and his men then came upon them suddenly. They made the attack. They no doubt caught them by surprise. They came at a time that would have been the most advantageous for Joshua and all the people of war with him, that is his army. And this element of surprise, no doubt, was very much in the favor of the Israelites. And they fell upon them. Verse 8, "And the Lord delivered them into the hand of Israel, who smote them, and chased them unto great Zidon, and unto Misrephoth-maim, and unto the valley of Mizpah eastward. And they smote them until they left them none remaining." Now they went as far as they could to the west. They went as far as they could to the east. Joshua's men pursued them, chased them, and smote them, and they left them none remaining. Verse 9, "And Joshua did unto them as the Lord bade him. He hoed their horses and burned their chariots with fire." So Joshua just simply carrying out the will of God, doing the things that God has asked him to do, and he's been successful at it now. He has routed these armies of the north. Verse 10, "And Joshua at that time turned back and took Hazor, and smote the king thereof with the sword, for Hazor before time was the head of all those kingdoms." Now Hazor is the one that we had spoken of in the very first verse, whose king was Jabin. Jabin, king of Hazor. It seemed that this king wasn't destroyed in the battle, that he did flee back to his home city of Hazor. And after Joshua had completely routed the armies and destroyed the armies, then he went back to the business of taking care of the individual cities. And so he turned back and took Hazor, and he smote the king thereof with the sword. And now Hazor was, as he mentions here, he was the head of all those kingdoms. So this was the chief man of all the northern part of Canaan, apparently, head of the other kingdoms. And now Joshua had smote him. Verse 11, "And they smote all the souls that were therein with the edge of the sword, utterly destroying them. There was not any left to breathe, and he burnt Hazor with fire." Now he treated Hazor in a peculiar way from most of the cities. That is, he destroyed it completely. He killed all the people therein and burned it with fire. Now, many of these cities they did preserve, and they dwelt in these cities that had already been built, but not so with Hazor. However, we're going to learn at a future time that the Canaanites did rebuild this city, and they settled there under another king of the same name, according to Judges 4, verse 2. Verse 12, "And all the cities of those kings, and all the kings of them, did Joshua take, and smote them with the edge of the sword, and he utterly destroyed them, as Moses the servant of the Lord commanded. But as for the cities that stood still in their strength, Israel burned none of them, save Hazor only, and that did Joshua burn." In Deuteronomy 6, verse 10, we have the statement that they would live in these other cities. "And it shall be, when the Lord thy God shall have brought thee into the land which he sware unto thy fathers, to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob, to give thee great and goodly cities, which thou buildest not, and houses full of good things, which thou fillest not, and wells digged, which thou diggest not, and vineyards and olive trees, which thou plantest not, when thou shalt have eaten and be full. Then beware, lest thou forget the Lord, which brought thee forth out of the land of Egypt, from the house of bondage. Thou shalt fear the Lord thy God, and serve him, and shall swear by his name. You should not go after other gods, or the gods of the people which are round about you, For the Lord thy God is a jealous God among you, lest the anger of the Lord thy God be kindled against thee, and destroy thee from off the face of the earth. So we see this intention of God was that they should have these cities and the houses and the wells and the vineyards. They should live in them and be well filled, but at the same time, they were to be very cautious that they not go after the gods of these people. They were to destroy the idols, the altars, and every vestige of idolatry that was left in these countries. So we see then that Joshua carried this out exactly the way that Moses, the servant of the Lord, commanded. The command originally came from Moses, and Joshua is simply still carrying out these commands. No new commands that Moses had already given. Moses' commands were still in effect. Verse 14, and all the spoils of those cities and the cattle the children of Israel took for a prey to themselves, but every man they smote with the edge of the sword until they had destroyed them, neither left they any to breathe. So they simply destroyed the men. The people were not allowed to continue to even exist, but they took the spoils as a prey for themselves. Here again, this is according to the plan of God. These people had lived in this area, had been so removed from God, they had so continually antagonized God by their idolatry, by their refusal to even give him any vestige of recognition, that now this was the wrath of God turned against them. Verse 15, as the Lord commanded Moses his servant, so did Moses command Joshua, and so did Joshua. He left nothing undone of all that the Lord commanded Moses. Now, this is a very interesting verse here. We see that the command came from God to Moses. Moses gave the law. We read about the law of Moses. The first five books of the Old Testament have to do with this getting to the point in which Moses had given the law. The fifth book, the book of Deuteronomy, is dedicated to the second giving of this law of Moses. So even though Joshua was a man who was close to God, he had miraculous intervention by God, still nothing that Moses gave by command of God was redone or was undone. Moses gave the command, his law stood. It was written down, it was available, and so Joshua had to refer to what Moses gave, what Moses said, and carry that out to the very letter. Now, the same is true of us today. Once the New Testament was given by miraculous means, once it was written down, once it was made available, once it was known as what he calls the unity of the faith, then we do not look for any revision or addition or subtraction of it. It is meant to be taken just like it's written. It's meant to be applied properly, put into its right context, and used. And today when we study that part of God's Word, we read it distinctly, we give the sense of it, and we cause the people to understand the reading. That's what's so important. We do not look for new revelations. We do not look for new information from God. We have that which is perfect. We have that which is complete. We have the total message from God given to us in our Bibles, which is the combination of the New and the Old Testaments. And as Jude says in Jude 3, it was needful for me to write unto you and exhort you that you should earnestly contend for the faith which was once delivered unto the saints. And that's what we have in our Bible, the faith that was once delivered unto the saints. God does not re-give and re-give and re-give this faith. Once it's been delivered, once it's been put into a form in which man can have it available, know it, read it, learn it, live it, then it has been once delivered unto the saints. So we do not look for another giving of the faith. We do not need new revelations. We do not need God to again confirm unto us this word. It's already been given. And consequently, then we take it as it's written. And so we see then that even in the case of Joshua and Moses, As God commanded Moses' servant, so did Moses command Joshua, and so did Joshua. Joshua still looks to the commands of Moses. Moses is dead. Moses is no longer with them. But his commands are just as effective, just as in force, as if Moses had been living and still giving them. Now this great principle of God that's laid down right here is one that we certainly should get well implanted into our minds. When God gives a law, and he specifies that it is to apply to a certain age or dispensation, then as long as that dispensation is in existence, that law is also in existence. God does not retract his laws. He does not have somebody else come and give a fresh interpretation of the law that's going to make it different or it's going to change it. His law is good and perfect in its original form, and he intends for it to stay that way. And so in the case of Joshua here, just as in our cases today, when we have a law given of God, although the one that gave it is dead and gone and we have no more miraculous communication with God, that law is in effect. So the person who claims that God has given him some individual instruction is mistaken. Anything that supersedes or changes what's already been given, then this does not exist. That is a falsehood, because God's law stands as given, and we're to obey it just as Joshua obeyed the law of Moses, although Moses was no longer living upon this earth. Well, that brings us to the end of our time. We're going to conclude at that point. Till next time, this is NC Crouch saying goodbye, friends.